Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Hello, and welcome back to Hack Rack. I'm Jed Wolpaw, and I'm thrilled to have with me today a new crew of anesthesiologists from Ohio State. They work with some of the other folks from Ohio State that I've interviewed before, but this is a new group, really fantastic folks, and I think we're going to have a great discussion. I've got with me today Dr. Rafal Kopaintrick, Dr. Omar Al-Qudsi, and Dr. Amar Bhatt. And the first two folks, Rafal and Omar, are critical care anesthesiologists, as is Amar. Amar is also a cardiac anesthesiologist, so he does both. And we're going to have a really interesting discussion today about their work looking at right ventricular failure in COVID patients. And as we, you see, as we go through that, we're going to be talking a lot about how they used ultrasound and POCUS, critical care ultrasound, to assess these patients. And then that'll lead us into a discussion about the new exam to get certified in critical care ultrasound, kind of what that's about and how people can look at that if they're interested. And then we'll talk about a little bit broader discussion of POCUS in anesthesiology for folks out there who are interested in learning more. So it's going to be a great, and guys, welcome to the show.
Thank you. It's a pleasure.
I do want to give a quick shout out to the newest member of our ACRAC team. That's Ryan Okonski. Ryan is our new social media manager. He's taking over for April, who's done an amazing job, but will be starting her intern year. And so will not have time to be doing the job for another year. And so Ryan's going to be taking over. We're excited to have him on board. And thanks, Ryan, for joining the team. All right. Let's jump now into our first topic, which is let's talk a little bit about right ventricular failure in ARDS in general and in COVID-19. Rafal, why don't you give us some background there?
Oh, yes. Yes. How are you guys doing? Thanks for having us again. As you know, patients with ARDS have a significant prevalence of RV dysfunction that has been described. So about 22 to 50% of patients who develop ARDS end up with having right ventricular dysfunction. And the reason why that's significant is because certain studies also have shown that the RV dysfunction is associated with mortality. So as the COVID pandemic started, the first cases described by the Chinese and then quickly in the U.S., the prevalence of RV dysfunction was being published. So when our patient cohorts started in the end of March and the beginning of April, we have also noticed that there was quite a few RV dysfunction that our patients have been developing. And more specifically, there were patients on ECMO. So we wanted to see if there's any sort of difference between our regular ARDS and RVD, or is there actually something more going on with these particular COVID patients. And as the pandemic progresses through the summer, there was an interesting paper that came out in JAMA Surgery in August about an experience of a surgical team out of Chicago who were cannulating patients with Protek Duos for RV protection. And they had quite significant findings of mortality of only 15% or so. And that really got us thinking about our patient cohort that we were experiencing between March and August. So we ended up sending a letter to the editor describing the reasons why we thought at the time the patients with COVID who were on ECMO had an increased prevalence of RV dysfunction. So at that time, we decided to do a retrospective study of all of our images that we have acquired over time and examining them for TAPSE, S prime, and all the classic RV measurements, and also add RV strain to the mix, as there was one study that also came out in July of 2020 that quoted RV strain as being quite good at finding mortality in regular COVID ARDS patients.
So that's great and really interesting work. Let me back up and just clarify a couple of things. So you mentioned this study where they put in ProTec Duos, which is essentially an RVAD, right? It's like a device which helps the right ventricle function. And so the idea here was that by when they put these patients on ECMO, they also gave them this right ventricular device to help, that they had much lower mortality than traditional patients on ECMO would. So the idea there was maybe by protecting the RV, they were preventing some mortality that might have been associated with RV dysfunction and failure. Is that right?
That is correct. So this particular device, it's a cannula that pretty much takes the blood from your right atrium and then delivers it to the pulmonary artery, skipping the RV, and hence the theory is protecting it.
Right. Okay. So that was really interesting. And then that led you to say, gee, what do our patients who are on ECMO for COVID-19 look like? And then you mentioned some of the things that you looked at. You said TAPSE, S prime, and RV strain. Tell us a little more about that. What are those things and, you know, how do you assess them?
Sure. So I guess let's just back up a little bit and talk about the right ventricle in general. So as you know, RV is quite a complex structure that is 3D, and we have measurements that are mostly one-dimensional at this time. And, you know, the classic measurements include the fractional area change, where you're just outlining the ventricle in systole and diastole and comparing the size and dividing it by the diastolic size. And with that, anything that's greater than 35% is considered normal. Then we also have the longitudinal change of the ventricle. So those are the measurements like TAPSE, which is just movement of the tricuspid valve in systole up and down, hence longitudinal, and as well as the velocity of that movement, which is described by S prime. So all of those measurements have been used quite a bit and have been validated in different patient cohorts, including pulmonary artery hypertension. And recently, over the last decade, RV strain or strain in general has come into practice. So most of the measurements that you will encounter in clinical practice is evaluating the strain of the left ventricle, but recently that has also been applied to the right side. So given that RV strain or strain in general is a little bit less load dependent, it's not as finicky in terms of getting your beam parallel to the ventricle, it potentially can be a better gauge of ventricular function. So we decided to also use that in addition to our classic RV measurements.
Great. All right. And so you put together this pilot study. Tell us a little bit about what you did and what you found.
Yeah. So throughout the months of our study, we would acquire images whenever our patients developed hemodynamic or instability or any other hypoxic problems. So we took 11 of our consecutive patients and then evaluated those studies thereafter. So during the initial images, we would acquire the TAPSE S prime, and then after the images were acquired, we then went online and evaluated the RV strain with a Thumbtack software. And at that point, we had three different examiners outlining the function of the ventricle, because as of now, there is still a limited amount of software available out in the world. So what we ended up doing is using our software that we have available at Ohio State called Thumbtack. So in order to do that, we had to use three different persons to validate our study and validate our findings.
Yeah. So I think I'll chip in here. This is Amr. I think, you know, we noticed an, you know, increasing incidence of hemodynamic instability in these patients, specifically COVID patients. We do have experience with ARDS and RV dysfunction historically through the 2009 influenza epidemic, 2008, 2009. And so we're used to this problem. It just, you know, our clinical suspicion was that we're encountering this much more frequently. And so I think given the clinical suspicion and our increase in patients, this is what we decided to do, is to do point of care exams and document their kind of progress or decline, whichever it may be.
And great. Thank you. And who was included? So was this all patients on ECMO, all ARDS patients on ECMO, all COVID patients? What was your patient population?
So, it was all incomers who were on VV ECMO during the pandemic. So our unit is mainly taking care of patients who are on mechanical devices and mechanical support. So 11 consecutive patients that were in our CVICU who were being supported with VV ECMO.
Okay. So they weren't necessarily all COVID patients, though they may have been. Do you know that if they all were?
Oh, they were all COVID positive patients who required VV support.
Okay. So 11 patients with COVID, presumably COVID ARDS, who required VV ECMO. Okay. So these are the patients you followed over time. And how often did you do the exams?
So our exams were triggered by hemodynamic instability and or refractory hypoxemia. So on average, our first exams occurred within 9 days into the VV ECMO therapy. And we included those first exams in our study.
Okay. And so what did you find?
So our findings were quite significant. So even though it's a pilot study, we did find that majority of our patients had right ventricular dysfunction as described by abnormal strain greater than negative 20%. Also, most of our patients, 80%, developed abnormal fractional area change with an average being about 22. And then finally, ventricular enlargement was found in majority of patients as well, about 63% of those. And interestingly, our classical measurements, TAPSE and S prime, did not come out abnormal in majority of these cases. So, which is very interesting because that means that the evaluation of longitudinal displacement of the right ventricle in this particular patient population might be insufficient, and we need to consider doing other modalities like strain and fractional area change.
Really interesting. So let me ask you a couple of things. One, how did this or does this differ from previous patients on ECMO? So is this uncommon to have these findings in patients on ECMO?
So this is actually a very interesting question that we were asking ourselves, like, is there actual world difference between RVD and ARDS? Is there a difference in RV failure in ARDS on ECMO? And is there any sort of novelty to the ARDS, ECMO, and COVID combination? So going back to just regular ARDS, as I mentioned previously, right ventricular dysfunction occurs up to 50% of the time. Now, when it comes to ARDS on ECMO pre-pandemic, there's very limited data out there. One study from 2020 was evaluating RV function actually with CT scanning and echocardiography, and they found about 18% of RV dysfunction in their patient population. Additionally, the ELSA registry study that was looking at patients between 2009 and 2013 show that there is that in 4% of the cases, patients on VV ECMO were transitioned to VA ECMO in 4% of the cases. So we can probably make an educated guess that some of those patients developed RV dysfunction. But in general, this is as far as our knowledge goes when it comes to RV failure in ARDS on ECMO. So now evaluating our results, those numbers are significantly higher than what's reported in previous studies in ARDS population.
And do you have any idea why that would be? Do we think there's something about COVID or about the pandemic that led to that? Or is it kind of hard to tell because of the small sample size?
Yeah, so at this time, obviously, we cannot make too many predictions from our study alone, but with reviewing of literature, we believe that there are some there's a specific pathophysiology of COVID patient that predisposes them to higher right ventricular dysfunction. And more so, there's also other additional factors that predispose patients with COVID ARDS on ECMO. So we would have to distinguish between both of these patient cohorts. So when it comes to COVID ARDS patients, early on in the pandemic, the ECHO reports have started stating that the increase, the enlargement of the RV was about 40% in the COVID newcomers. And then right ventricular dysfunction occurred 27% of the time. And the reason why that is twofold. It is increase in the afterload that is more prevalent than in the regular ARDS, and also direct myocardial toxicity. So when we talk about the increase in the afterload, interestingly, these patients experience high level of microangiopathy with thrombosis. So we believe that that's probably one of the primary causes of why that occurs. And if you read the autopsy reports, most of these patients, more than 50%, do have microangiopathy with a platelet fibrin-rich thrombi. Additionally, we do have a pro-inflammatory state that affects the pulmonary vasculature. So COVID itself, or the SARS-CoV-2, enters the cells of the endothelium, injuring them, so causing additional injury, and then we develop endotheliitis in addition to that. So given these three factors, the afterload significantly increases, causing probably the dysfunction in the right ventricle. And then obviously we all heard about the cases of myocarditis and fibrosis, or even post-COVID syndrome, where patients develop problems with their ventricles. So that also is adding to the dysfunction of the right ventricle, in our belief. And so now we have to add the ECMO to it, to the equation. So what does that exactly mean? We feel that a lot of our iatrogenic therapies for refractory hypoxemia can add to the dysfunction of the ventricle. So as you know, beta blocker therapy for refractory hypoxemia is one way to counteract that effect, which will also have, obviously, negative inotropic effect on the already struggling right ventricle. Additionally, these patients require long-term ECMO that sometimes lasts, you know, over a month with very high flows. So some people suggested that non-pulsed flows at very high levels can also overload the right ventricle. And then lastly, the delirium is quite a problem in these particular patients that require significant sedation to in order to bring them to RAS negative 3 or so. And most of the drugs that we use these days for sedation also have a certain degree of negative inotropic effect. So for all these reasons, we think that the RV dysfunction in ECMO is even more prevalent in COVID patients.
Yeah, it's really interesting. I mean, that is a huge number of potential reasons why this might be different. So you, even though you've only has this small pilot study, you've clearly thought this through, and there's some really interesting potential pathophysiology of why this might be different. I want to go back to what you mentioned before, which was that the strain and the area change and size were different, but not so much the TAPSE and S prime. Why would that be? Any hypotheses for why those would be relatively normal?
Hey, this is Amar again. So yeah. I think, you know, it's interesting that we found that because, you know, traditionally we wouldn't expect that there would be a, you know, abnormality in the two values, or at least they should be congruent in showing that they're depressed. I think that this kind of highlights the value of strain because it's load independent. You know, the fact that we can use the strain as a load independent variable to kind of prove that even despite a normal TAPSE or a normal fractional area change, that the ventricle is still abnormal. So I think you know, in terms of why that's the case, I think one of the big things is that it's a load independent variable, and so whereas TAPC and everything else is load dependent.
Interesting. Okay, say a couple words, if you would, about what that means when you say load dependent versus load independent, so that everyone understands.
Sure. I think what I'm referring to is that, you know, when looking at the ventricular function, whether on the left or the right, certainly there, the ejection fraction, fractional area change, TAPC, S prime, lateral E prime, all these things are variables that are preload dependent. And so, preload and afterload dependent. So all these variables can be very dynamic in the situation where the patient is either preload down, preload up, afterload down, or afterload up. And so strain kind of takes that out of the equation, because you're looking at it, you know, you're looking at velocity of the myocardium itself and the function of the myocardium itself, where it doesn't necessarily have to do with preload or afterload.
Okay, that makes sense. And so that seems like a really important thing to keep in mind, and may, as you said, be part of the reason why it played a role here in these patients. Okay, so you guys, we talked about what you found and kind of why those things may be the way they are. Tell me what you think in terms of how does this apply clinically? Does this mean that there's a suggestion that people's practice should change? Is this pointing you towards kind of what that other group did that you mentioned with putting in essentially right ventricular support devices? Tell us a little bit about what conclusions you're drawing from what the work you did.
Yes, I think at this point it's still too early to guide all of our medical decisions based on these studies. But as more evidence comes out, we suggest first and foremost to ensure that you use more than one measuring modality of evaluating your RV dysfunction. So don't only use TAPC and your S prime. Make sure you also do fractional area change and RV strain in this patient population. And given the fact that placing the RVAT is by itself a very risky procedure with you know, significant risks to perforation of the RV, I believe that at this time, even though we have some evidence, it's still too early to recommend that in every patient population. However, if you do have a patient who already has a struggling right ventricle that you know of, and you are going to be placing them on ECMO, you should consider maybe alternate cannulation that has been described by that particular group.
Great. Well, this is really interesting. And as you said, I mean, at the very least, making sure that you're not relying strictly on TAPC. You know, I'm sure we've all had the situation where a resident or fellow will tell us the TAPC and say, therefore, the RV is fine. And clearly, you need more information than just a TAPC, and your work highlights that. So I think that's great. The other thing that's really interesting, of course, is that this is all stuff you're doing as critical care anesthesiologists using surface ultrasonography. And so I think this is a nice place to start talking more about that. And again, any of you are obviously welcome to comment, but Omar, I know you wanted to talk a little bit about, and I think it would be interesting, tell us a little bit about now that that's becoming more common and the fact that people who are not cardiac trained, but simply anesthesiologists in critical care are doing this and able to do it. What does that mean for the specialty or the subspecialty of critical care anesthesiology? And for folks who are interested, tell us a little about this exam. What is this certification in critical care echo, and how can people achieve that certification?
Definitely. So this is Omar. Omar is also right here, two different four-letter Omars right here. But so I think this is a really exciting time for our specialty in anesthesia critical care. To highlight it a little bit, the NBE back in 2019 began administration of the critical care echocardiography exam. And the purpose of this exam was to differentiate between basic critical care echocardiography and advanced echocardiography. And one of the things that they kind of highlighted was that there are dynamic indices of preload sensitivity, ventilator-induced heart-lung interactions, and integration of thoracic ultrasonography with echocardiographic findings. And they wanted to kind of create some competency level to differentiate that between, you know, like you said, your fellow coming and saying, hey, the TAPC and the RV looks like this. So they, in 2019, they began administering this exam. It was kind of collaboration between a few societies, seven societies representing cardiology, emergency medicine, pulmonary critical care medicine, and anesthesiology through the Society of Cardiovascular Anesthesiologists. And so the purpose of this exam was precisely just to create an avenue to certify critical care physicians in advanced echocardiography. And I think our study in particular shows the benefit of having physicians trained in this modality who can use this not only to change clinical management, but also to advance the field from a research standpoint.
All right. Hang in there. Stay with us. We'll be right back, and we will discuss who is eligible for this exam.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
All right, welcome back. So who is eligible? What kind of training do you need to be able to sit for this exam?
Great question. So there are a couple different pathways. There is the supervised training pathway and the practice training pathway for people who haven't done a critical care fellowship. That practice training pathway is set to close in 2026. And the purpose of the exam is to allow anybody who's completed a fellowship in critical care. So not only pulmonology, anesthesiology, emergency medicine, but also our surgical colleagues and our neurology colleagues, and try to have some sort of standardized process across the board to allow anybody who's done a critical care fellowship to sit for this exam.
Great. So it sounds like there's a little window for people to sort of get grandfathered in. They didn't do a fellowship, but they've been practicing critical care. They've used ultrasound. If they want to pursue this exam, they can do that up until 2026. But after that, you have to have done a fellowship in critical care through one of these various boards.
Precisely. Yeah. And it involves documenting, particularly in these critical care fellowships. So this is part of the criteria for eligibility, is that during your critical care fellowship, you have to document that you've performed 150 critical care exams. And they have a specific definition of what a full complete critical care exam is. And they define that as any obtainable element. So that includes spectral Doppler. It includes indices of fluid responsiveness, as well as all obtainable views. Following obtaining those 150, which isn't a small number, and I think that highlights the value of this certification in that it's really intended for advanced purposes. Then there's the exam that they administer in the beginning of every year, January, which is a 200 question multiple choice with videos and images exam, examining a whole scope of topics.
Great. And I've heard, I have not taken the exam, I've heard it's very challenging. That, you know, one of my colleagues who actually did an echo, he did like the cardiology echo exam. He did enough kind of some other pathway and did that, but then took this and said this was essentially as challenging as that. Like, this is very challenging. Is that your experience as well?
Yeah, it's a challenging exam. So before this exam came about, the ASE exam, which was the cardiology exam, used to be administered for people who had critical care training. But unfortunately, we were only allowed to get testimony status, and you could never actually be certified, which is why they actually, they took this, they created this pathway. And, both myself and Umar have taken the advanced TEE exam, the PTE exam, and it's very similar to that. The three of us here have all taken the critical care exam and, thankfully passed it.
Congratulations. Well done.
Yeah. And so, it goes through a lot. You know, it's meant to explore the entire scope of critical care ultrasound. So it does have some stuff as far as like fast exams, thoracic ultrasound, vascular access, but the bulk majority of it is cardiac. It goes through valves. It goes through diastology. It goes through advanced indices. And so, it really takes a lot of studying for the exam itself, but it takes an intensive effort on part of the critical care fellow during their fellowship to sit there for the 52 weeks that they're there and try to accumulate these exams, to spend time with faculty who have this other training in order to hone this skill. And I think it's definitely meant to make people stand out as opposed to just basic ultrasonography.
Yeah. Well, let me ask you this. What if folks do a critical care fellowship And for whatever reason, they don't do 150 documented exams. But they do finish the fellowship, they graduate, they get board certified in critical care. Can they make up those exams and still sit for the, make up the documented echoes and then sit for the exam, or no?
They can. What it involves is, again, finding those the log of 150 exams. And then there's a specific a definition as far as who would read those exams for quality assurance. And usually it's somebody who has certification, be it advanced TEE certification or critical care ultrasound certification. So that pathway is still there for the fellows who didn't have the ability to collect those numbers back when they were in fellowship.
Great. So let's say somebody out there is thinking, man, you know, this sounds like a lot of work. I got to do 150 exams. I've got to study like crazy. I've got to take this really difficult test. What would you tell them are the benefits? Why should they think about doing this?
Yeah, I think that's a great question. You're putting down money, you're putting down effort, you're in an already busy fellowship year and kind of transitioning your focus away from just critical care medicine, which is such a huge field in and of itself. I'd say first and foremost, the ability for us to do the study. Like if we hadn't done the studying on our own and been able to master the skill or attempt to master the skill, it doesn't allow us to further our field. We see a lot of things in our experiences, you know, honestly speaking, as critical care anesthesiologists, we see things that other specialties don't necessarily see. And so for our ability to actually quantify that, use that to further research, I think that's a huge thing. But of course, not everybody's a research oriented individual. And so what other reasons are there? You know, quality control, like you said, a fellow or a resident coming to you and saying that, hey, like the RV's blown or the LV looks underfilled when in reality it's a giant PE and the RV is dilated, you know? So offering a minimum level of quality for our patients, particularly as the critical illness for our patients continues to increase and the complexity continues to increase, being able to use our findings to change our clinical practice and have the ability to back that up. Credentialing and billing is a huge thing as always. There are a lot of initiatives out there to figure out a way to bill for these exams. You know, if you have a quality improvement process throughout your hospital, and you're able to save these images, then it becomes an opportunity for revenue generation. And then it's confidence into the diagnoses, you scale it into the OR, other avenues. You know, I as a fellow, there were often times when I'd have a patient in the PACU who needed an ICU admission. It was easy enough for me to run down there and, you know, do a quick a POCUS exam. And I think Umar will be able to touch a little bit more about some of the overall benefits of a POCUS when it comes to anesthesia and critical care. And then, you know, expanding our anesthesia practice, and there are plenty of educational opportunities for everybody around the hospital when it comes to critical care ultrasound.
Great. Yeah, I think it's there's a lot of really attractive aspects to this. And when you think about kind of the future of certification, we obviously just took a big step with this new exam not too long ago. Where do you think it's going from here?
Great question again. So as with everything else, it seems like more exams always seem to pop up one way or another. There is a perioperative point of care ultrasound course that the ABA now provides for anesthesiologists. I can definitely see, you know, the TEE exam split into basic and advanced portions, basic being geared more towards your general practicing anesthesiologist, maybe even some residents. And we could certainly see some sort of split between the basic and advanced when it comes to residents. And already within the ABA, and I was one of the first people to take the OSCE exam, and part of the OSCE exam does include echocardiography on it. And so, you know, just for our residents themselves, it's becoming an essential part of their training. And so I think that there's it's definitely just continues to grow within the field of anesthesiology.
Yeah. Yeah. I love that you mentioned the possibility of a kind of division of this into a basic and advanced, because I think right now it's clearly advanced. And there is probably, I think the expectation that every anesthesiologist would do this is probably not reasonable. Maybe it's a reasonable expectation that every critical care anesthesiologist in the future would have this, but certainly having a basic option for, as you say, maybe even residents who, you know, could throughout the course of residency get 50 or whatever the exam requirement would be, and then, you know, take a less rigorous or less comprehensive exam, but covering kind of the basics. So that'll be very interesting to see if that comes about. I agree. All right. Let's talk more about the kind of history and uses of point of care ultrasound. And Amar, I think you're going to do that for us. You want to take us through kind of historically where this has been and where it's going?
Yeah. I think historically the utility of echocardiography for anesthesiologists lied, you know, in the operating room, right? So with cardiac anesthesiologists in the operating room, the ability to use transesophageal echocardiography during procedures to guide operations, to give information that may not have been, you know, gained preoperatively. I think that's where the real value came from. And I think historically that value of TEE guided information and management has now since trickled out of the operating room. And, you know, as leaders in perioperative medicine, I think it can be applied everywhere, in the preoperative clinic, in the PACU, and intraoperatively. And so I think to Omar's point of, you know, involving the residents and kind of, you know, they're kind of the next in line to gain the benefit from this imaging modality, you know. And so I do think that there's been a real big push from our societies and leaders in our society for training residents in ultrasonography. I just got done reviewing all the ABA keyword items and stuff for our own ultrasound curriculum. And every year there's an increasing number of echocardiography questions, point of care ultrasound questions. And so I think as a society and as especially, we're definitely heading that way.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. This is coming up a lot as we mentioned, this is included on the OSCE. This is becoming something that is no longer just limited to the cardiac operating room. The other thing is there's really the technology is advancing, right? So I don't have one myself, but I have colleagues who carry around in their fanny pack an ultrasound probe, right, that they can hook up to their phone.
Yeah, so I think portability definitely has revolutionized kind of usability in here in that, you know, we don't have a bulky ultrasound machine to drag around. We for our residency program have just have invested in butterfly ultrasounds or handheld ultrasounds. And, you know, I think the educational value of those devices is unlimited. The downside is, I will say, is that as a hospital system and as a medical center, we're trying to figure out how to kind of, you know, regulate those or, you know, make sure the people using those are know what they're doing with them effectively. So I think there's two sides to that coin. I think they do provide a unlimited educational product, but at the same time, you know, we have to be sure to make sure that it's being used in a reasonable way.
Yeah, I think that's a really important point. And we hear this come up sometimes, right? This question of, let's take a patient who there's concern for a PE. And whereas once, that resident or fellow overnight may have just sent them to the scanner because that was the only way to definitively know the answer to that, you could imagine a situation where now they take out their butterfly ultrasound, they take a look at the heart, they say, oh, the RV is, you know, blown, it must be a PE. And again, I'm pushing it a little bit here in terms of the extremity of this, but, and then they give TPA, right? Whereas that may not have been the right diagnosis. They may have misread the ultrasound especially if they aren't trained in how to do that. So that's, I think what you're getting at is if we're going to let everybody loose with an ultrasound probe, we need to have some way of knowing that they're not misdiagnosing things. They're not relying on an exam that they may not be trained to do, right?
Right. And the thing I try to kind of drive home when I'm teaching residents and fellows, even at a very early level in their intern year or CA1 year, I really try to drive home the fact that, you know, you're going to use this tool as an adjunct to clinical decision-making. You know, I feel like it's a great tool to have, but you have to know how to use it just like everything else. And so with that, you know, with the training and with curriculum in place, simulation, those kind of things, I think, but I think we're slowly getting there. So I really try to focus on, you know, clinical implications and when to use ultrasound, not just let's put a probe on it and find something.
Right. Okay. So let's talk about how this can be worked into training. So we just talked about why it's important that people actually be trained. So how have you seen this being done? How are you doing it? And how would you recommend that training programs whether that's a residency or a fellowship, start to build this into their training if they haven't already.
Yeah, that's a great thought. You know, I think it's been challenging because the way the training programs are structured, the residents are not consistently available as a unit all the time. And so I think trying to find a time to kind of get everybody together and talk about it is one thing. So we've kind of done, we did it for the critical care fellowship here at Ohio State last year. And we devised a series of 14 lectures, didactic lectures. And then in that, we kind of intermixed simulation and scanning sessions and then image review sessions. So the point of our for the fellowship program was we wanted to have them give them the foundation they needed for the NBE exam, as opposed to the residency curriculum, where it's more of a longitudinal curriculum. We started at all levels, starting at intern year with exposure to ultrasound. And we, you know, I envision it as kind of subspecialty driven. So if they're on a pain rotation or a regional rotation, the utility of ultrasound and regional, as opposed if they're on a PACU rotation, it's kind of like a rescue ultrasound curriculum. So we've tried to provide a longitudinal curriculum where they get didactics throughout the year, then they get focused lectures on specific subspecialties, critical care, or even the depths of critical care with like LV function, RV function, and then kind of more general ones with lung ultrasound, which can be utilized anywhere. So I think for residents, I think a longitudinal curriculum involving didactics, and then we do simulation sessions. We have a TT transthoracic simulator as well as a transesophageal. And I think the combination of those and then live practice, in real time scanning, I think closes the loop on all that.
Yeah, I think that's right. And, we recently, a couple of years ago, went from having just a didactic POCUS curriculum to adding a hands-on scanning and reading part one-on-one with critical care trained attendings. Because I think that, as you say, that's so key, just to have a lecture on something that's such a hands-on procedure isn't going to be enough. You have to do it, and you have to do it with someone who knows what they're doing.
Yeah, I mean, it's certainly been a challenge this past year with all the in-person restrictions, and I think it's been hard, but we were lucky to have those butterfly ultrasounds floating around on different rotations, so the residents were able to utilize those independently in a small group setting, and so we were lucky for that. But I think in the future, having like a larger group scanning sessions and monitored or kind of proctored sessions are going to be valuable.
Great. I agree. All right. Lastly, let's talk about kind of the different ways you can use POCUS. What can you look at? We mentioned a little bit earlier about how the exam covers not just cardiac, but also lung and abdominal exams. But tell us a little bit about what the different things you can use POCUS for are.
Sure. So as you mentioned, the big categories are certainly cardiovascular or hemodynamic instability, and then lung ultrasound is another big category. So I think the utility of, and then followed by gastric and abdominal ultrasound. So I think in terms of utility, I would rate those in that order, where cardiac is probably the most useful, followed by lung, and then followed by gastric ultrasound. And the utility of lung ultrasound is even more up and coming now with airway ultrasound. There's initiatives in airway ultrasound for, endotracheal tube placement, from endotracheal tube placement to identification of the crackle thyroid membrane for, crackle thyroidotomies. And so I think, those kind of uses are just continue to increase. So, intraoperatively, I always teach the residents, there's always, ultrasound for detecting mainstem intubations, ultrasounds for pneumothorax. I think all of these are super helpful and valid uses, which are when trained, can be done very quickly and effectively to kind of rule out all major issues.
Right. No, I think there's so many neat things. And I feel like all the time I'm learning, sometimes from my colleagues, sometimes even from my trainees, some neat new use. So you mentioned using it to look at esophageal intubation or rule it out. Certainly, right, mainstem intubation, as you said. I have a colleague who's actually experimenting with using an eye probe to look at elevated intracranial pressure by doing an ultrasound of the eye. And then I have another colleague who showed me this, which I love, which is that, you know, sometimes you put an IV in let's say the AC, maybe you put like a Rick line in the AC and you're not, you know, you're trying to figure out, is it definitely in? I don't know. It wasn't that clear cut. You know, you can't really tell by ultrasounding that area. It flushes fine, but you know, maybe it's a big arm with a lot of soft tissue and you're just not sure. So what he does is he puts an ultrasound probe on the chest and flushes some agitated saline into the Rick. And if you see it in the right heart, then you know you're in the vein, right? I love that. I think that's such a neat, quick, easy way to feel very confident that your line is where you want it.
Yeah, I think we're extrapolating a lot of those things from TEE, which I use it. I use TEE for that while placing central lines to confirm, you know, in addition to seeing the wire, to confirm like presence of, you know, agitated saline in the right atrium. So I think we're continuing to slowly extrapolate a lot of those things that could just make, you know, day-to-day kind of practice a lot simpler.
Absolutely. All right. This has been such a fun conversation. I think really covered a lot of great material. Anything to add before we move on from any of the three of you?
I would just say that 81% of people who took that exam passed it. And so despite the fact that it's challenging in the content as well as the ability to get that certification, the majority of those people were anesthesiologists. And I think that especially now as this thing is coming up, it's a good time to be an early adopter.
Yeah, that sounds great. All right. Well, everybody out there, think about it. If 81% of people can pass, so can you. Think about whether you want to do it, and I will do the same. All right, gentlemen, let's turn to the portion of our show where we make random recommendations. Do you have something for the audience that you've been listening to, checking out lately? Could be a TV show, movie, a podcast, anything you've been up to that you'd recommend people check out.
All right, I'll go first. Mine's going to be a little bit different. Over the last weekend, I went to the United States' newest national park. So that's New River Gorge National Park in West Virginia. Amazing whitewater rafting, great hikes around the area. It's a beautiful part of the United States. It might be a little hard for people on the West Coast, but it is just absolutely fantastic. And you can even go down 1,000 steps and find like an old mine and just explore that for a little while. A little bit tough to get back upstairs, but really, really cool part of the U.S. that's, I think, under-discovered and really, really pretty.
Very cool. That's awesome. I didn't even know about it, but it's something, and it can't be that far from us, so worth checking out. That sounds amazing. Thank you. All right. Who's next?
I'll go next. I just finished watching The Mayor of Easttown on HBO, which is an amazing show with the main actress being Kate Winslet, who always does a tremendous performance. And not only is that good, the storyline is great, and it's actually a nice cinematography. And I would really encourage everybody to watch it, especially for the very last shot of the show. We have to see it to know what I'm talking about. But yeah, I would strongly recommend it.
Awesome. Yes, I have heard really good things about it, too. So thanks for the recommendation. All right. Last but not least.
So I've been doing some more reading about endurance training and kind of that kind of thing. So I just recently finished up a book by David Goggins called Can't Hurt Me. Highly recommend it. It's an incredible story of this guy who's was the only one to complete all three branches of the military's training. So Army Rangers, Marine Corps, and Air Force Rescue. And so it's his incredible childhood story about growing up, and he's an endurance athlete and an ultra athlete who recently won the Badwater race, which is a race from Death Valley up to a mountain in Colorado. I can't remember the name. But anyways, great story. Highly recommend it. Show some true grit.
Wow. It sounds like it must take some serious grit to do that. That's a great recommendation. Thank you. And I will say that my wife and I have, and I know we're late. I know probably many people out there have already watched this, but we came late to the show and started watching Parks and Rec and have found it to be just fantastic. It is really a fun, light, entertaining show. We watched Ted Lasso, which I have already shouted out, which we thought was just incredible and weren't sure where to go next. And my brother and my sister-in-law recommended this. And since we had never watched it, we decided to check it out. And it's great. It's just fantastic. So highly, highly recommend, if somehow like me, you have not yet watched Parks and Rec, that you check that out and give it some time. The first few episodes of the first season, it took a little while to really get into, but then it becomes really just amazing. All right, gentlemen, that was really a pleasure, and I'm so glad you came on the show. Thank you for spending some time here today.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
All right, that was fantastic. Ohio State is representing on ACRAC, and I love it. These guys are doing great work. Hopefully you found that interesting and helpful as well. Let us know what you thought. Go to the website, acrac.com. You can leave a comment, and others can learn from what you have to say. You can also join the conversation on Twitter. We're at ACRAC Podcast, and I'm at Jay Wolpaw. You can also join the ACRAC Facebook group and follow us on Instagram. More exciting social media stuff to come. If you are a fan of the show, please consider going to Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your podcasts and leaving a comment and a rating. It really helps others find the show. If you'd like to support the making of the show, you can become a patron by going to patreon.com/acrac. That's patreon.com/accrac. You can also make a donation anytime by going to paypal.me/acrac or looking up Jay Wolpaw on Venmo. Thank you so much to those who are already patrons and have already made donations. It makes a big difference, and we really appreciate it. Huge thanks, as always, to our ACRAC crew. That's our tech lead, Dr. Brian Park, our new social media manager, Ryan Okonski, and our former social media managers who remain on the job as production assistants, helping with some of the show notes. That is, of course, Dr. Kimmy Akash Cooley and Dr. April Liu. Our original ACRAC music is by Dr. Dennis Kuo, and you can check out his website at studymusicproject.com. All right. That is it for today. For the ACRAC Podcast and Drs. Kopeintrick, Al-Qudsi, and Bott, I'm Jed Wolpaw. Thanks for listening. Remember, what you're doing out there every day is really important and valued.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.